Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
If there are any conditions on all that bailout money the government's been doling out for the past several months, we taxpayers have no idea what they might be. That's because the Treasury Department, which controls those purse strings, won't say. But soon it might start answering to Congress. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon, in for Kai Ryssdal, and we wish him well getting over whatever it is that's been going around on this Friday, the 9th day of January. We've now run through the initial course of treatment for what ails the rest of us, and the Treasury Department, having prescribed the first half of the $700 billion Troubled Assets Relief Program, is preparing to go back to Congress for a refill. TARP, you'll recall, was passed last fall to give banks the economic health and confidence to provide loans and credit to borrowers. The first dose hasn't exactly worked as advertised, and Congress wants Treasury to know there'll be some new restrictions on the next half. Here's our Washington Bureau Chief, John Dimsdale.
Plenty of members of Congress are upset that neither the banks nor the Treasury Department have disclosed what happened to the first $350 billion in TARP money. Today, the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, Barney Frank, introduced new conditions for the second half.
There is such unhappiness in the country and in Congress with the way in which the Bush administration administered the first $350 billion that we have to be very specific about what we expect in the second $350.
Frank's new rules require banks to report quarterly on how they're using taxpayer money. The top 25 executives at companies that get funds can receive no bonuses or incentive pay, and the companies can't use TARP money to acquire other banks. Some of the next installment would have to go to domestic car companies and to help homeowners avoid foreclosure.
And I believe there will be some language that will ultimately say, and if they choose not to use any of the authority in those categories, they're going to have to explain why. They're going to have to tell us there was no chance.
It will be the Obama Treasury Department that will ask for and spend the second $350 billion of TARP money. Representative Frank says the president-elect's economic team is thinking along the same lines, although the transition team wouldn't confirm that today. The banking industry is also talking to Congress, and Treasury Secretary nominee Timothy Geithner will be pressed at next week's Senate confirmation hearing about his plans for TARP. He'll have to explain how he'll track TARP spending. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
So the next question is, what happened? Why does Congress feel it has to clamp down with more oversight of the Treasury Department? We got some answers today from a congressionally appointed oversight panel. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
Congress created the independent panel as a watchdog over the $700 billion financial bailout administered by the Treasury Department. Today, the watchdog howled about gaps in how Treasury is monitoring taxpayers' money.
Treasury's the one who set up the system, and they didn't put any tracking mechanisms on it.
That's Elizabeth Warren, the Harvard law professor who's heading the commission, speaking on ABC. The commission issued a scathing report today. It urged Treasury to keep better track of the bailout cash, and it said Treasury hasn't used the money to help homeowners directly as Congress intended. Kathleen Day says Treasury hasn't lived up to its obligations to Congress. Day is with the Center for Responsible Lending. She says Treasury focused too much on getting banks to help homeowners voluntarily rather than forcing loan modifications.
Mandatory adjustments, mandatory lowering of monthly payments on a mass scale, modifying even millions of loans quickly.
But Scott Talbot says that's not so easy. Talbot is the chief lobbyist for the Financial Services Roundtable, which represents the nation's biggest banks. He says many mortgages were sliced up and sold as securities to different investors who would all have to sign off on a loan modification.
It's difficult to come up with a blanket program to help large groups of homebuyers.
Treasury had no comment, but the watchdogs on the commission will have plenty more to say at a hearing next week. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Now, here are some millions that haven't raised the ire of Congress. 50 million barrels of oil sloshing around on huge supertankers right now. They're not going into port, not getting unloaded. They're just waiting for the price of oil to go up. It's a financial play known as contango, and a lot of investors are getting into the act, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
Contango refers to a market condition in which the future price of a commodity is higher than the cost of buying it today. Right now, investors can lock in oil futures contracts to get paid $46 a barrel in March. They can fill a supertanker right now for just $41 and change. It's pretty cheap to keep the tanker floating around in the ocean. When it unloads in the spring, the investors make a tidy profit, more than $3 a barrel. Daniel Yergin is author of the Pulitzer-winning book, The Prize. He says there's a glut of oil right now caused by the global recession, but futures prices are going higher because OPEC has promised to cut production. And, says Yergin, oil traders are reading something else in the economic tea leaves.
There's a bet here that all of the stimulus, new economic programs are going to work, and that by the second half of the year, we're going to move out of recession back into economic recovery, and demand will start rising for oil again.
But, says Fred Dahl, a shipping consultant based in London, parking all that oil offshore could roil the markets all over again.
There is one thing to keep in mind, though. There's no free lunch. And at some point, all that oil that is in storage on tankers will be released to the market again.
When that happens, dozens of supertankers steaming into port in the spring, full of crude, there could be an oil glut again, setting off a new round of investors doing the contango. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Wall Street reacted, as you might expect, to word today that the country's jobless rate has climbed to its highest point in almost 16 years. We'll give you the trading details when we do the numbers. These days, the first thing Dire Straits brings to mind isn't the name of a band from the 1980s. There is no money for nothing. President-elect Obama has brought the phrase back to its more literal meaning this week. He's used it time and again to describe the state of the nation's economy. And he used it again today in reaction to the latest grim unemployment news from the government. The Labor Department counted more than 500,000 workers slashed from payrolls last month. That pushed the unemployment rate to 7.2%. It was bad enough at 6.8% the month before. Mr. Obama says the jobless news adds urgency to getting his $800 billion stimulus plan passed by Congress. Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle, though, have been questioning proposed tax cuts and seemingly endless government spending. But according to commentator Angela Glover-Blackwell, no one is talking about the people who need it most.
To jolt the economy back to life, the Obama administration is ready to spend $500 billion or more on infrastructure projects. I'm glad the thinking is big, but it also needs to be different. If we do this right, the stimulus package can boost America's economy for the long run and be the greatest anti-poverty tool this country has seen in generations. For decades, the current system has poured money into new highways to far-off suburbs, enabling even more sprawl and making us even more dependent on our cars. That kind of thinking just doesn't work anymore. America needs smarter, more targeted spending in people, places, and projects that gets a solid return on our investment and actually builds up communities too often left behind. But how do we do that? First, we need to invest where people live. More than two-thirds of Americans, including the vast majority of the nation's poor, live in the top 100 metro regions. These urban areas and inner-ring suburbs are the economic and social engines of the nation. We can have an immediate and sustainable impact by rebuilding their schools, parks, and transit systems. When we invest in public transit, we connect working families to the good jobs they need. When we lay new broadband lines in poor communities, we can unleash a new wave of entrepreneurs and small business owners who have been cut off from the digital revolution. When we encourage the construction of new grocery stores in communities long abandoned by national chains, we put people to work, improve healthy eating, and bring economic vitality to overlooked communities. And when we build any project, we can set aside 1% or 2% of the cost to create job training programs. Developing a pipeline of ready and able workers is vital and a wonderful chance to expand opportunity for low-income young people. But none of this will happen if we spend the stimulus money the way we've been doing for years. We need to make this chance count. Smart, targeted infrastructure projects are precisely the stimulus we need to help millions of Americans realize their true potential.
Angela Glover-Blackwell is founder and COO of PolicyLink in Washington, D.C. Your thoughts on the subject, you can tell us at marketplace.org. Just for the record, today marks the end of the first full week of the new year. And already, based on the news so far, we can tell 2009 is going to be a doozy. Let's see. Record high unemployment, retail bankruptcies, rocky stocks. But for better or worse, we'll have a new guy in charge. To talk about all this and more, we have Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine and Felix Salmon of Portfolio.com. Welcome back to the show, both of you.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, Bob.
The inauguration just around the corner now, and the president-elect came out with, I guess you could say, just a few stimulus proposals this week, from bridge repair to teacher training. The big question of the week seemed to be, though, how we get there from here when we face such a huge deficit. Lee, how do we get there from here?
Well, it's a good question. We're talking about vast sums of money, obviously, and it's a risk. I mean, anytime you're talking about deficit spending, you're talking about sticking future generations with a tab. But the thing here is that we're looking at an economic slump that's so severe, it's really not anything we've seen since the Great Depression. And the judgment call that's being made is that the risk is far greater to not do something, that we need to do something immediately and think about now instead of the future.
Felix, Mr. Obama was hinting that perhaps the size of this deficit is going to affect the size of the stimulus program. Is there a risk of the stimulus being not big enough as opposed to too big?
There's certainly a risk that it won't be big enough. We do need a big stimulus to turn things around and stop things from getting worse. On the other hand, deficit constraint, I think, is quite small. I think that debt to GDP levels are relatively manageable right now. The government can borrow money at very, very low interest rates at very long terms. And so, although there are future generations who are going to have to pay this off in 30 years, I don't see that as a huge problem today.
I talked to somebody from the Cato Institute earlier this week who said, look, we don't really need to spend all this money we don't have anyway. We should just let the private sector take care of this problem. Do we have to have this?
The private sector can't borrow money, Bob. That's what happens in a credit crunch. The government has access to pretty much unlimited amounts of money at very, very low interest rates. You go along to the private sector and ask them how much money they can borrow, they'll say none. And if they do borrow, they'll just put it under the mattress. They want that liquidity.
But I've also talked to a lot of people who say, look, the government can't really, the president in particular, can't really do much about the economy. Lee, what about that?
I think he absolutely can. I mean, he's talking about creating 3 million jobs, immediate projects that can create jobs that can happen now. I mean, that's what helped after the Great Depression. You also have to think about it. We've already tried to throw all of our other tools at this. You know, interest rates are as low as they can go. We've spent trillions on bailouts, and the recession has deepened since then. So we're clearly looking at desperate times.
Mr. Obama also talked about tax cuts, a $1,000 cut for 95% of working families. Is that a good thing, Felix?
I like that idea. I think especially if he does it in the deductions from your paycheck, there's been talk that instead of just getting a $1,000 check in the mail, which you might think about saving rather than spending, you're just going to find your take-home pay go up by about $20 a week, and you're not really going to notice that in the same sense. You'll be more likely to spend it, and it's going to be more likely to stimulate the economy that way.
I'm not sure I totally agree with that. I mean, it's almost like a rebate repackaged using the tax system as a delivery mechanism. So I think that was really an effort to rally support from the Republican side for this whole package.
But the president-elect was saying several times this week the economy's in dire straits. So it sounds to me like he really wants a quick pop here.
Oh, he does. But to get the quick pop, he has to have support on both sides of the aisle. So I think with the tax bill, the $300 billion tax bill he proposed earlier in the week, I think top on his mind was just enactment, whatever he has to do to get it passed.
And tax rebates and spending are both forms of fiscal stimulus. It's not like they're, not interchangeable in many ways.
So how tough is the president-elect's job going to be when he takes office?
It's extraordinary. I mean, it's really unprecedented. Things are probably going to get worse before they get better. He's got a massive problem to deal with. On the other hand, he has a historic opportunity. I mean, it's not every day that an incoming president gets to affect U.S. economic policy. It's historic.
You folks are no fun at all to talk about fresh starts really in the new year, huh?
But Treasury bonds are still going to be in a bubble. We can have a bubble somewhere, right?
Well, somewhere along the way. Yeah. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine and Felix Salmon, who blogs for Portfolio.com. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
Coming up, tales from the top from young bankers.
I remember just sitting there and staring at this piece of paper and just saying, like, holy shit, like, this is going to my bank account.
But first, let's do the numbers. Investors gave stocks the pink slip today after another dismal jobs report. The Dow Jones Industrial Average backtracked 1 2/3%, or 143 points, to close at 8,599. The Nasdaq unloaded 2 8/10%, or 45 points, to end at 1,571. The S&P 500 dropped 2 1/10%, that's 19 points, to finish 890. For the week, breathe deep now. The Dow sheared off 4 8/10%. The Nasdaq gave back 3 7/10%. The S&P 500 forfeited 4.5%. Tech stocks helped drag the market down today. Apple slid 2.25%. Cisco threw off 4.75%. Rambus fell more than 39% after the chipmaker lost a patent case. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-bill fell to 2.39%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com. Let us do the work for you. Download Marketplaces after the bell. A podcast which makes sense of a week's worth of business news. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Treasury Department releases the federal budget for December. The Transportation Research Board convenes its annual meeting, also in Washington. And in Detroit, the show must go on. Over 700,000 people are expected to attend the 15-day North American International Auto Show. Press preview starts Sunday. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Do you remember what you were doing exactly 8 years ago today? Well, just so happens I do. I was covering the big International Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. And I recall the thousands of vendors putting their latest gadgets on display back then weren't really all that concerned, even though the tech bubble was just going bust. It was on a lot of minds back in 2001, and I put the question to the founder of the show, Jack Wayman.
What about this economic downturn, and is this industry concerned about that at all?
We really aren't, and I tell you why. Since 1920, when radio went on the air, we have never had anything but an increased year for the last 80 years. We've never gone down.
Well, that was then. This is now. And these hard times must really be putting that resilience theory to the test. Our tech expert, Kevin Pereira, is at the show for us this year. Kevin, welcome back to the program.
Oh, Bob, always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
What's the floor like this year? Has CES really scaled back, or are they still pushing ahead with their virtual video guns blazing?
The guns are in some corners of the hall shooting blanks this year. I mean, the convention itself is, to say it's recession-proof is like claiming the Titanic can cut through icebergs. We're seeing that not only has the actual square footage of the show been cut back this year, but many, many vendors have cut down on their booths entirely, and they're opting to kind of participate in CES through press releases or online web blurbs, as opposed to actually exhibiting on the showroom floor. So definitely the economic downturn that we're experiencing has absolutely affected the convention this year.
Well, why doesn't the theory still hold true, though? I mean, the argument is that people are going to be staying at home more and they're going to need cheaper entertainment at home.
Yeah, the argument holds for certain sectors of the tech market. For example, we're seeing internet delivered to your television is a big theme this year. It has been every year. But instead of just a shoebox with wires and LEDs and printed circuit boards hanging out of it, we're seeing actual products that look like they might hit store shelves this year. And the reason people are looking to that is they're saying, hey, look, cable bills and satellite bills are getting way out of control. They're just too expensive. So if a television set can offer me a wired connection or a wireless connection to the internet right out of the box, well, then I might cancel my cable and just stream Hulu or stream NBC or Comedy Central or YouTube videos directly to my television set.
Well, speaking of gadgets, where is the big buzz this year?
The big buzz, just like last year, I think revolves around OLED. If you don't like acronyms, it's too bad. This one's not going away anytime soon. That brand new HDTV that you just bought for your living room is not nearly good enough when compared to an OLED. It's an organic light-emitting diode, meaning that the screen itself doesn't have to be lit by any sort of backlight or fluorescent tubing. The screen is going to emit its own color, its own brightness. And when you see these visuals, it is, I mean, the nerds are moths to a flame here. But the big announcement that's really taken CES by storm, if you remember last year, it was all about the iPhone. Rather, 2 years ago, I'm sorry, 2007. This year, Palm shocked everybody. I mean, here's a company that had an operating system and that made handheld devices that people were starting to, quite frankly, forget about. And they came out and they announced the Palm Pre, which has many Apple and iPhone fanboys saying they're going to chuck their device out the window the moment it hits store shelves.
Why so? Why do I need that device?
Well, this device is a true multitasking phone. You can run multiple applications at once. It's got a full QWERTY slide-out keyboard, which the iPhone simply doesn't have. And it's really net-enabled. The phone can cut and paste and send multimedia message, which the iPhone surprisingly still cannot. So there's a lot of reasons to be excited about a new operating system to compete with the iPhone.
Kevin Pereira, you may know him from television as host of G4's Attack of the Show. Kevin, thanks for joining us.
Bob, thank you again. Always a pleasure.
It's been said that Wall Street is a young person's game. Each year, hundreds of college and biz school graduates show up in New York, dreaming of wealth and power. And what a game it's been. But thousands of jobs have now vaporized in this financial crisis. A lot of the computer screens on Wall Street might as well be flashing the words, game over. Bonuses have shrunk, financial firms have cut back their campus recruiting, and the young masters of the universe in training may be an endangered species. Here's our New York bureau chief, Amy Scott.
A few years back, a video popped up on YouTube. It seemed to epitomize the young banker culture in New York. A 23-year-old financial analyst named AJ sipped a $200 cocktail surrounded by women he called arm candy.
Thursday night's the night that we bowl. I mean, we go top down, models and bottles.
Models and bottles. Back then, young bankers were pulling in record bonuses and dropping the cash on nightclubs and condos.
It's very much been like a work hard, play hard, ball hard kind of thing.
That's Amit Chatwani. You might have noticed how both of these guys use the term ball.
It's just basically behaving like a rap artist.
Chatwani is not a banker, but when he moved to New York after college, he lived with a bunch of finance guys. He set out to satirize their antics on a website he calls Leveraged Sellout.
You know, it's just around this culture of egregiousness. You know, you're making, you know, maybe like 90 to 100 grand a year, but you're kind of acting and living like you make like 5 million. And that's the culture that I thought that needed to be captured.
He eventually did that in a book called Damn, It Feels Good to Be a Banker. It described an era when 23-year-olds straight out of college made annual bonuses in the high five figures. Guys like Sean Moore. He did a two-year analyst program at one of the former Big Five investment banks.
You know, you go in and you meet a couple people in your group who are doling out the bonuses, and you get a piece of paper and there's a number on it. And I remember just sitting there and staring at this piece of paper and just saying, like, holy shit, like, this is going to my bank account.
The next year, that number was even bigger. This was at the peak of Wall Street payouts. Moore says he did have a few nights out, like AJ in the video. One time, he and some friends dropped a few $1,000s buying bottles of liquor at a club.
But, you know, people who are in the work know exactly what you're going to do on Monday morning, right? You're going to You're going to go sit in your chair and look at Excel for 8 hours, and then you're going to print some pitch books and send them to a banker, you know, for the most part. So I think anyone in banking would say they're not necessarily living the dream.
And that's the downside of banker life. Moore says he probably worked 80 to 90 hours a week for a year and a half straight. Analysts do all the grunt work behind mergers and acquisitions. Kemper Ohlmeyer worked at another big investment bank, though on the hedge fund side.
The reason so many bankers, especially young ones, are such caricatures is because they have so little free time outside of the banking world, and so they make the most of it. You know, you go get a Hamptons house and during the summer because you want the 4 weekends you're going to get for the entire summer to be great. Time becomes the scarcest commodity for a banker.
Sean Moore wanted more of it. At the end of July 2007, he left his Wall Street job and has lived off his savings ever since. He did volunteer work in Ghana, took DJ lessons. Now he's writing a book about his experiences. And the world he was a part of isn't at all how he left it. Just weeks after Amit Chadwani's book came out, Lehman Brothers collapsed. Layoffs on Wall Street are forcing a lot of young people to reconsider their ambitions. Generous severance packages and savings help them do it. Matt Fiordaliso lost his job last summer at a hedge fund. He signed up for cooking school.
It was going to be finally my opportunity to do something that was enjoyable to me. Eventually, I would have loved to own my own restaurant or something like that.
But then an offer came through, a job helping investors value mortgage-backed securities. In the end, Fiordaliso says staying in finance was too good to pass up. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, several late-breaking published accounts say Citigroup is deep in talks to sell its retail brokerage business, Smith Barney, and could merge it in a joint venture with another big brokerage named Morgan Stanley. According to reports from the Wall Street Journal, Reuters, and others, Morgan Stanley would own a controlling 51% stake of the joint venture. Citigroup would eventually sell the remaining stake to Morgan Stanley over the next 3 to 5 years. This news comes on the heels of word that former Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin is resigning from Citigroup. Rubin has been roundly criticized for his performance at the banking giant, and he admits in a letter to Citigroup CEO that he didn't foresee the market deterioration that's led to a plunge in share price over the past couple of years of 90%. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 143 points, 1 2/3%. The Nasdaq lost 45 points, 2 8/10%. The S&P 500 dropped 19 points, 2 1/10%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up Monday, looking for help after losing a job.
I think if you have financial problems, then you're more likely to be depressed. You're more likely to have relationship problems, job instability. To me, it just gets at the core of all of it.
I'm Bob Moon. You made it. It's the weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.